people might be theoretically open to making sense of their regrets, to reframing them, to making sense of them, to extracting lessons from them, but we don't know how to do it. No one ever teaches us how to do that. I think that's the big problem. And what's true at an individual level is doubly true at an organizational level. Find me a business school anywhere on the planet where they have a course in making sense of organizational regrets. You're not going to find it.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change Podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and build heart-healthy organizations with a culture of purpose, trust, and integrity. I'm your host, Tobias Sturson, and I'm the co-founder of Heart Management. Before we get into today's topic, I wanted to thank all of our listeners who have supported the people of Ukraine, and especially Agape House since our last episode with Agape Ukraine co-founder Sergei Bolchuk aired. If you want to help, we can recommend a donation to Agape or to the UNCHR and their important work serving people displaced by the war in Ukraine and other conflicts around the world. So now to the topic of today's podcast. Regrets. Probably not the most inspiring word in our vocabulary. It seems like we've tried to unburden ourselves from regrets, thinking that it's an ancient idea that does not really fit into life in the 21st century. We're supposed to be solely future-focused, not dwell on the past, and since everything happens for a reason anyway, why regret something that we can't change? I don't know about you, but I have regrets. When I speak to leaders about values-based leadership, I often return to one of those regrets. That I didn't stand up and speak out when I became complicit in a psychologically abusive culture. That regret weighs me at times, but it also fuels me. It's an important driver behind this podcast and our work on a world where healthy cultures become the norm and not the exception. When I read that Dan Pink had just released a book about regret, I got really excited. For those of you who might not know his work, Dan is one of the top management writers today and author of several New York Times best-selling books on business, work, and behavior, including Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us, and When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. This episode focuses on Dan's latest bestseller, The Power of Regrets, how looking backward moves us forward. I think it became a very raw and personal conversation for me. When we recorded it, I had actually recently asked someone for forgiveness that I should have dealt with years earlier, but for specific reasons, I hadn't. Since ethics is a big part of this podcast, we focus a lot on the power of moral regrets, and we also talk a lot about corporate regrets, not just personal. As I've worked with organizations navigating highly publicized scandals and toxic cultures, I've learned that the instinct is to move on and shift focus to new horizons really, really quickly. However, if they genuinely want to move forward, they first have to learn the power of embracing regret. So for those of you who are leaders and HR and ethics professionals, which I think is most of our audience, this podcast is for you and it is for your organization. So now, without further ado, let's jump into my conversation with Dan Pink. Daniel, it's really, really a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
So I first got acquainted with your work in 2010 when you spoke at a conference about what motivates us. And a bit later, I bought your really, really insightful book, Drive. And it's one of those few books that I actually keep referring back to repeatedly. And the book makes the case for the few of our audience who haven't read it that financial rewards can be a motivation, but other intrinsic motivators are equally essential drivers. And you talk about purpose, mastery, and autonomy. And I wanted to start this interview like I normally do with a bit more of a personal question. What drives and motivates your work?
Well, I think The biggest driver for me, Tobias, is just curiosity. I like to try to figure stuff out. And if I can figure stuff out and try to make sense of it and explain it to other people in a way that's useful and they'll pay me for it, that's a pretty good gig.
It really sounds like it. So in the book Drive, you make the case that if we only focus on financial rewards, we will not get the best out of the people we work with. And I want to try to connect this thought with organizational culture and ethics, which is something we discuss a lot on this podcast. A number of the ethics researchers that I've interviewed have pointed out that incentives are among the biggest drivers of ethical or unethical behavior. And today there's a lot of talk about corporate purpose statements, and I'm sure you're aware of that. And still organizations often rely very heavily on financial rewards and unfortunately sometimes on bonus structures that really have a strong potential to drive unethical behavior. So my question to you is, what are some organizations, since you wrote the book, that you've seen that have inspired you in how they have been intentional about making purpose an operational driver in their organization and really something that can drive motivation?
Yeah, well, let me clarify what the research says a little bit, because it's not, you know, what I did in that book is I looked at about 50 years of research in the science of motivation. And the problem isn't financial rewards per se. The problem is the difference between controlling rewards and non-controlling rewards. In particular, a certain kind of reward that is a controlling contingent reward, or like what I call an if-then motivator. If-then motivators tend to be effective for simple tasks with short time horizons because people like rewards, and those contingent rewards get us to focus. And so if you know exactly what you need to do and how to get to the finish line, then that kind of focus is actually very helpful. What the research also tells us, though, is that if-then rewards are less good for complicated tasks with long time horizons, because there you want to have a much more expansive focus and you want to have motivational energy that is more renewable. So that's it. And then when it comes to certainly high-stakes short-term rewards can lead to it. They don't inevitably lead to unethical behavior, but they can. And any kind of system that has high-stakes contingent rewards is a system that someone will try to figure out a way to game. And so that's one big problem. The other big problem is that anytime you have, what I've seen is that a lot of these compensation systems or incentive systems, there's nothing bad about incentives per se at all, but sometimes these incentive systems become so complicated, so baroque, so complex, that they require an entire administrative apparatus to manage, which exerts another cost on things. So in terms of purpose, what I find is that there are some organizations that are animated by some of them are animated by a sense of purpose. This is going to be somewhat controversial, but I find that a lot of, at least, purposes in the conversation among pharma companies and biotech companies more than many other kinds of companies. I think that other kinds of tech companies do a kind of performative kind of purpose. There are other companies in the healthcare space that are more easily reach for that sense of purpose. But I don't think it's necessarily tied to one kind of company or one kind of domain. That is, any company, any organization out there can find its purpose. And the way that purpose is stated is less of a top-down process than a bottom-up process. That I think the most legitimate purposes are emergent, where you're reflecting the voices of what people in the organization are saying. You're not hiring a purpose consultant to come in there and confect a purpose statement that nobody remembers after 2 weeks.
That is so incredibly true. And for new listeners to our podcast, I can really recommend also going back and listening to Professor Colin Mayer from Oxford University and on this topic of purpose. But I really wanted to talk to you about your new book, which is The Power of Regret. And I was so incredibly happy when I saw that you had decided to tackle that topic. That's true. Because like you, and when I read your book, I have the same experience that I've heard so many people say, that they have no regrets And it's always left me dumbfounded. And I actually had some conversations with people before I heard about your book, just about that idea that, to me, that means that you've never hurt anyone or yourself or the environment or anything else. And before we dive deeper into what you found out in your research, I just have to ask you, since you write about regret, I have to ask you a more personal question. So what is a regret that has been a kind of very instructive and powerful in your life?
I mean, like everybody, I have plenty of regrets. I think the one of them that has, it's good, two good words here, powerful and instructive, because I think that that's, I think regret done right can be both of those things. And the power comes from giving us insight into what we value. And so the best example of that for me, I think, is some regrets about kindness earlier in my life. And, you know, I was never anybody who was, I never bullied anybody. I was never that kind of aggressive person who affirmatively hurt others, or at least affirmatively and intentionally hurt others. But I was in many situations when I was in school, when I was in university, when I was a young professional, where people were not being treated right. They were being, particularly when it comes to exclusion, they were being left out, they were being excluded. And I saw it happening, and I knew at the time that it was wrong, and I didn't do anything. And that bothers me to this day. And so going back to your point, it's like, well, there's something powerful about that, because if that kind of regret is lingering for all that time, it has a power, and the power that it has is it's shining a light on what matters to me, and it helps me realize that kindness is more important to me than I might have consciously realized. So that's one thing. The second thing is that it's also, as you say, it's instructive. So it's teaching me how to do better. It's saying that I should be a kinder person. When I'm in those situations, I should not just stand by and let it happen, but that I should step in and do something about it. And in very, 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 very small ways, I have. So if you were to see me at, say, a social gathering, and there are like clumps of people around, and then there's maybe one person who's marooned by him or herself, I will always bring that, not always, but very, very often will bring that person in or widen the circle to allow more people to join the conversation. And those are both, and that's an outgrowth of this feeling of regret that I have about not being kinder when I was younger.
I think that's so interesting. And of course, you talk about this from the perspective of kindness or a lack of kindness, but I'm also seeing it from the perspective of a lack of maybe speaking up in that sense.
Well, I mean, I think it is a regret in many ways about speaking up. It's both of those things. It's sort of the regret about speaking up on behalf of others, or speaking up when you see something that's wrong.
And I think as leaders, and I mean any type of person in organizations, which is of course a lot of the focus on this podcast, I think that's one of those regrets that I think a lot of us hold. And when I think about some of my most substantial regrets are that I didn't stand up. And of course, in my case, it was a much more serious thing. But I became a part of a very destructive leadership. I became complicit in a very unhealthy culture and really a severe mistreatment of people that, I mean, to this day, it's something that I'm going to regret it for the rest of my life. And that regret and what I've since learned from that situation have really become powerful drivers for me and my work on healthy organizational culture. It's behind our company. So in that sense, you could say it's like it's informative and powerful, but it's, of course, also painful.
Well, you had it exactly right. This is the thing about regret, is that you can't have it both ways, Tobias. So what we want is we want that clarification of what we value, and we want the instruction on how to do better. But a lot of us want it without the discomfort, without the pain. It doesn't work that way. They have to come both. And the question then really is, how do you use that discomfort and pain as a signal? And what happens too often, especially in North American cultures, is that when that negative feeling approaches, we ignore it and pretend it's not a real signal. Or if that doesn't work for very long, we end up wallowing in it, which is also bad too. What we want to do is we want to confront it. We want to think about it. We want to face it down.
And I think that's so, so interesting. And I think that maybe part of this, that when we say we have no regrets, we also, in a sense, lose a bit of our moral compass. that the things that should kind of instruct us, the things that we have experienced, and I think maybe famously, I think President Trump said something about like having no regrets, or at least he didn't have anything that he needed to ask for forgiveness for. And I guess that says something about a person's moral compass, doesn't it? And I guess something that we're wanting to, in a sense, give away, or we want to be without something that is actually really, really important.
Yeah, well, I mean, regret is sometimes about morality, but isn't only about morality. So if I have a regret about, say, not starting, like staying in a lackluster job and not starting a business, I don't know if there's a moral component to that, but there's still regret. So I think that people who say they don't have regret show, I think, a profound lack of self-awareness and a profound, at some level, a lack of intelligence. Because what they're saying by saying they don't have regrets is that they don't have anything to learn, and that's always a dangerous sign.
If we talk about then the positive, so what are the potential benefits of regrets?
Well, I mean, the benefits come when we treat it properly, when we don't ignore it, we don't wallow in it, when we confront it. And when we do that, regret, well, we talked about it at a broad level, it clarifies what we value and instructs us on how to do better. At a more specific level, there's a lot of instruction and a lot of guidance for leaders. For instance, leaning into our regrets, confronting them, drawing lessons from them, it helps us become better negotiators. Helps us become better problem solvers, helps us become better strategists, helps us become better parents, helps us find more meaning in our lives. There's a pile of evidence showing that leaning into our regrets rather than eliding them can yield guidance on how to do on how to do better. The trouble is, as I said before, is that no one ever teaches us how to do that effectively.
So you talk in your book about four categories of regret, and I was just thinking, could you just give us the very, very quick, rough outline of what those are?
Sure. So for me, that they're around the world. So here's what I did. I gathered regrets. We now have over 19,000 regrets from 109 countries. And when I looked at those, certainly the first 15,000 of those regrets, what I found is that around the world, people had the same four regrets, exactly as you say. But these regrets didn't have much to do about the main areas of our life. That is, we tend to think, at least I tended to think about, and other researchers tended to think about regret as like, oh, there's a career regret, there's a finance regret, there's a health regret. And what I found is something more interesting deeper down. So one of them is foundation regrets. Foundation regrets are, if only I'd done the work. These are people who made small decisions early that accumulated to bad consequences later. So they saved too little and spent too much. They smoked. Another category, boldness regrets. If only I'd taken the chance. These are people who at a juncture in their life could play it safe or take the chance, and they didn't take the chance. They didn't start the business. They didn't go on a trip. They didn't ask out someone they were interested in, and now they regret it. Third category, which we've flicked at a little bit, are moral regrets. Moral regrets are, if only I'd done the right thing. You're at a juncture, you can do the right thing, you can do the wrong thing, you do the wrong thing. Not everybody, but a lot of us regret it. And then finally, our connection regrets, which are, if only I'd reached out. And these are regrets about relationships, the full gamut of relationships that we have. And when these relationships come apart, and they usually come apart in slow, undramatic ways, we want to reach out, but we think it's going to be awkward, so we don't. We think the other side's not going to care, so we don't. And these relationships drift apart even more, and then we regret it. And so those are, so foundation, boldness, moral, and connection. Those are the four core regrets that around the world people seem to have.
As you were gathering all this data and researching this topic, what was one thing that just really stood out and surprised you?
I think that the thing that surprised me was exactly that, was the universality of it. That is, I went and, you know, gathered these regrets from all over the world, saying, okay, there's got to be some national differences that, and the national differences were scant. So if I were to show you this database and, you know, block out all the identifying information, just show you a regret that came in, I think you might have a hard time saying, is this from a 51-year-old guy in Stockholm? Is it from a 23-year-old person in Miami, a woman in Miami? Is it from a 46-year-old woman in Bangladesh? I think you would have trouble determining that. What's more, I did a piece of quantitative research, a giant public opinion survey of the American population, where I gathered an enormous sample, largely in order to make safe claims about demographic differences, and there weren't that many. And so I think it's the universality of it that surprised me more than anything else. I mean, I went looking for difference and I found commonality.
And I just have to ask you this. So when you approached your publisher or your agent about the idea of writing a book on regrets, did you get pushback so that this was perhaps a bad idea or a topic that people don't really want to read about?
A little bit of that, but I mean, I think it was easy to overcome. I mean, and you know, in a way, it's sort of like judo. It's like you use that as to you use the strength of the resistance to propel yourself forward. So, which is the kind of resistance that we get on this topic is exactly the reason why the topic is so urgent, because people don't want to talk about regret, but the evidence is overwhelming that they should. And once you engage them in the conversation, it ends up being one of the richer conversations that they have.
I think that's so incredibly true. And so you talked about these four categories of regret, and you mentioned that one of them is moral regrets. And we've already talked a bit about that, but since we talk a lot about ethics on this podcast, I wanted to hone in on that one. And you write something that I found so interesting. You write that moral regrets are a peculiar category. They are the smallest in number, yet the greatest in variety. They are the most individually painful, but they may also be the most collectively uplifting. And I wanted to ask you about that. What does it mean to you that they are possibly the most collectively uplifting?
Well, I mean, thank you for picking up on that. I think they are uplifting, because if you have people who are bothered 30 years later because they bullied somebody, if you have people who are bothered 40 years later because they stole something, if you have people who mistreated another human being or mistreated the planet and they regret it a decade, two decades, three decades later, I think that's a good sign. I think it what would worry me more is if people didn't care about that. And so the fact that they're still bothered by it all these years later suggests that most of us want to be good. And that when we're not good, we get signals saying, hey, you know what, I can do better. And so I think that in a weird way, the existence of these moral regrets is ennobling. It suggests that deep down, I think almost all of us want to be good. We want to do good. We want to actually be decent people. And when we're not, we feel bad about that.
And I think something that is so interesting when we think about this topic of regret, we think about, for example, if we think about regret on an organizational level or even on a national level, I mean, for example, when we have Holocaust Memorial times of Holocaust Memorial, you could say that that's a time of a collective regret, and that's something that is actually really important in the life of a people. And I'm just thinking of applying that into an organization. I sometimes suggest that I've worked with some organizations that have gone through scandals, and I've sometimes suggested to them that they should select a day and just say, this is a day where we remember what brought us to that place and made us make those type of decisions. What's your perspective on that?
I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great idea, and we have precedent for this in a number of different realms. So you mentioned, you know, on a national level, you can take a very contemporary example, which is South Africa, which had decades and decades of apartheid, which is just, you know, obviously morally corrupt. And then the country changed, and instead of, now what they could have done is said, okay, we're going to ignore that, put your fingers in the air, da, 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 never talk about it again. We could also then exact vengeance on people, or we could, you know, wallow in it. They didn't do that. They had a commission called Truth and Reconciliation. That's what it's about. You want to actually find the truth, and you want to try to reconcile it as with who you are today, as a way to do better in the future. We see this in certain kinds of religious traditions. Catholicism has confession and repentance. What you're describing is actually somewhat akin to, in Judaism, to a Day of Atonement, where in Judaism you have a single day carved out of the calendar that is about atoning for your sins. And so I think that at an organizational level, that is is effective. And I think the broader approach is also effective too. What you don't want to do is you don't want to say, if you have organizational regrets, you don't want to ignore them because they exist. Yeah, that's delusional. But you don't want to over-index on them and say, oh my God, we're completely flawed, we're hopeless, we have no chance, we're broken. What you want to do is you want to confront them. You want to think about them. You want to use them as engines for going forward. And I think that's true for individuals. I think it's true for organizations. And I think it can be true for for nations. This country, my country, I mean, you know, I'm an American, and in America today, we are wrestling with this, and it's a very controversial issue. When you think about the fact that much of the early days of our country was built by people who were enslaved, that the people who appear on our currency were people who enslaved other human beings. Now, we can say, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to put my fingers in the ears and never acknowledge that. That's a bad idea. You can also say, oh my gosh, we're just a fundamentally flawed country. We're stained. We're irredeemable. I think that's a bad idea too. What we want to do is say, all right, let's have some truth. Let's have some reconciliation, and let's use what we learned to move forward.
And I think this is so, so interesting. And I've many times told organizations that you can be awesome in so many ways and still flawed in others. And that's a part of what it is to be human or an organization. But I think the drive, and again, going back then to organizations that have gone through scandals or highly publicized scandals and crises, which are things that I've been involved with. And then I think they are interesting to look at because they are just a kind of bigger example of something that so many organizations go through. But what I find so many times is that the drive is so strong to just move on, that the drive is so strong to just kind of let the past be in the past, not to maybe say, okay, kind of this happened and it's not going to happen again, but not taking the time to actually look at why did this happen. And I've sometimes led organizations through that, you could say, a process of regret, where you actually go through and look at what happened with our culture, what drove us to this place, what did we learn, what don't we want to become or be in the future, and to actually then and admit that to their organization and admit it publicly. And I've also seen that there's an incredible power in that. But so often we just want to move forward. And why do you think we find it so hard to kind of stay there for a moment and get the power, I would say, out of the regret to be able to really move forward instead of just realizing 5 years into the future that we're still there, that we still haven't left?
I think it's two reasons. Number one is that most of us, myself included, in a given moment will choose short-term comfort over short-term discomfort. I think that's one part of it. And then second is that we don't know how to do that. I think that's the bigger problem, is that people might be theoretically open to making sense of their regrets, to reframing them, to making sense of them, to extracting lessons from them, but we don't know how to do it. No one ever teaches us how to do that. I think that's the big problem. And certainly, I mean, and what's true at an individual level is doubly true at an organizational level. You know, find me a business school anywhere on the planet where they have a course in making sense of organizational regrets. You're not going to find it.
I really want you to help take us through that process. So to find a way to approach regret in a much more constructive way. And you talk about some different steps. Would you just want to take us through that?
Sure, sure. So I like to think of it as three stages: inward, outward, forward. Inward, outward, forward. So inward, you got to begin by reframing how you think about the regret in yourself. At an individual level, one of the things that we do when we make mistakes is the way we talk to ourselves is just cruel. It's harsh. It's ridiculous. We would never talk to other people the way we talk to ourselves. And so the solution there is to avoid doing that and to reframe the regret in yourself by treating yourself with kindness rather than contempt, and by recognizing that your missteps, your flaws and mistakes are part of the human conditions. Believe me, I'm not the only person with kindness regrets. The fact that I have a kindness regret does not make me special. It makes me human. It makes me one of many, 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 many people with those kinds of regrets. And so Begin with self-compassion by treating yourself with kindness rather than contempt. Outward, there's a lot to be said, and you were hinting at this in many ways in a lot of your questions, Tobias, with disclosure and talking about these regrets. So disclosure itself is an unburdening. We misstate how people will react to our disclosures. We think that when we disclose our screw-ups, people will think less of us. Often, not always, but often they think more of us. But the most important thing about disclosure is that it's a form of sense-making, that these negative emotions are very abstract, they're blobby, they're amorphous. And when we convert them into words by telling somebody else about them, by writing them down, we make them less menacing, and that begins the sense-making process. So that's the outward. And then forward is we've got to extract a lesson from them, and you have to do that systematically. And the way to do that is to get some distance from them, to zoom out. And so it could be things like asking what you would tell your best friend to do. It could be things like talking to yourself in the third person. It could be things like projecting yourself out 10 years and looking backward. So anything you can do to get some distance. And so what we want to do is self-compassion, treat yourself with kindness, you know, forgive yourself a little bit. The next step is outward, disclose, convert to language to make sense of it. And then finally, take a step back and draw a lesson from it. And when we do that, it's not very hard, but just no one ever taught us how to do it. When we do that, we can use these regrets as an engine for future progress, and it actually helps minimize our regrets of the future.
That's so incredibly powerful. And I'm just thinking, do you have an example of a person or an organization that you've seen kind of how they've handled this process in a good way?
Well, I mean, I don't know. There aren't many examples at the organizational level at all. I think that's part of the problem. I think for individuals, there are many examples. I mean, there are many examples in the book. So let me take an example of a woman who had a connection regret. She had a friend who she grew up with. She's American. She grew up with this friend, and they were very close growing up. They went their different ways at university, but they still stayed in contact. And you know, as they went out to start their lives. And then this one woman hears that her friend has a pretty severe form of cancer. And so she wants to reach out. She says, I'm going to call her. I'm going to text her, see how she's doing. She doesn't. She thinks it's going to be awkward. She thinks it's going to be weird if she just reaches out after a couple of, you know, several years. So she doesn't. She contemplates it again. She doesn't reach out. And then when she finally gets around to calling, her friend had passed away that morning. So that's a terrible regret that a person has, and you can't do anything about that. So what do you do with that? Well, what you do with that is you treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt. You don't say, this is meaningless to me, because it's not. Nor do you say, I'm the worst person in the world, because that's not how you would treat somebody else. So what she did is she talked about it, she made sense of it, and she said, I'm not going to do this again. And then sadly, she had another friend who also faced a life-threatening illness. And in this case, she behaved very differently. She talked to the friend a lot. She called, she texted, she visited. And that friend also sadly passed away. But this woman, her name is Amy, didn't have any regrets about that because she did the right thing in that case. She reached out. And so there are many, many stories of people who take this simple, systematic approach to dealing with their regrets and end up better for it. Not worse. They end up stronger, not weaker. They end up learning more, not less.
And I'm thinking that in the culture of today, where I think there's a lot of, you could say, naming and shaming, that we might be increasingly reluctant to share our regrets, and maybe especially as leaders, because we don't think that there will be any grace. And if we think about this from a philosophical perspective, I think that maybe our problem with dealing with guilt and regret, and if we would use a religious term, sin, is also it connects with that we don't really have any grace, because we can't really talk about the issue, so we can't really give grace for it either. What's your perspective on that?
I think we've underestimated how much grace people are willing to offer, how much grace and forgiveness people are willing to offer. I think woefully underestimate that. I don't think that we underestimate. I think that we don't extrapolate enough from our own experience. So if you say, if somebody came to you with a regret, would you think that they're a terrible person? Or would you say, wow, I understand where you're coming from, and then maybe offer some grace? We'd say, well, of course, I would offer understanding and grace, but no one else would. And it's ludicrous. So I think that, you know, we end up being bad predictors on a lot of different things. So we end up being bad predictors about, I mean, it's a lovely, the lovely concept of grace and how often you're willing to get it. The lovely concept of forgiveness and how often you're willing to get that. And then even, you know, we tend to think that people are more dissimilar from us than they really are. So I'll give you an example. So I have a lot of regrets in this database about bullying and people who bullied people when they were kids or young adults. And I have several people who told me that who went back and actually apologized to the people whom they bullied. And almost to everyone, the people who were bullied forgave. They weren't that troubled by it. They offered grace. I think that most of us would do that. So, I think a good starting assumption is that if we start with the assumption that other people are kind of like me to begin with, then you're going to be right more often than you're wrong.
I call this kind of practicing courageous humility. The idea, and I think for leaders that it's one of the most, I think, important part of being a leader, that we practice courageous humility, that we're like able to actually put into words how we have wronged people or how we have contributed to an unhealthy culture, for example, or whatever that is, and that we're willing to name it and deal with it. And I'm thinking from a leader perspective, if we think an organizational leader, and where you have a regret, for example, about which I think most leaders have in terms of an employee that you didn't speak up for somebody, you didn't recommend somebody, you didn't something that you didn't do, or something that you did in terms of being too harsh or whatever. Are there any kind of specific things that you would say to an organizational leader in terms of how to constructively deal with their regrets in an organization?
Well, I mean, I think you actually use the same basic principles, is that you acknowledge the flaws and offer yourself grace. I think that's a lot of times we don't offer ourselves enough grace. So acknowledge the flaws, offer yourself grace, disclose to make sense of it, and then this is really important, extract a lesson from it and make sure that you honor that lesson. So when you say next time we're going to X, Y, or Z. The other thing is that you focus a lot on these moral regrets, which are fascinating, and you focus a lot on regrets where you've hurt somebody, but a lot of regrets that people have are regrets of inaction. They're regrets about things they didn't do. And they don't necessarily have a moral component to them. And this process is the same in that case. You know, I'm a big believer in small wins and in starting small. So for the leaders out there, what I would suggest is take one regret of your own or one organizational regret and just work through the process. Treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt. Disclose it, write about it, talk about it to make sense of it, and then affirmatively extract a lesson from it and decide what you're going to do next time. And try it once with one thing and see how it works.
You also talk in the book about the idea of anticipated regrets and how we can use the power of things that have not happened. And you also talk a bit about the downsides of that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, a lot of times with anticipated regrets, they tend to be pretty good. There are two big problems with it. One is that in certain cases, we over-anticipate how much regret we're going to experience. And therefore, we make a risk-averse decision. So that can be difficult. The second problem is that we can't anticipate every regret. We can't minimize every regret that we have. And if we do, we'll drive ourselves crazy. So what we want to do is we want to anticipate the most obvious and most significant regrets. And once again, this World Regret Survey database tells us what that is. So one technique would be at an individual level is you're trying to anticipate your regrets and you're trying to figure out what to do today. So you can say, okay, so what is the me of 10 years from now going to care about? What is the me of 10 years from now going to care about? And I think we can make a pretty safe bet what the you of 10 years from now is going to care about. The you of 10 years from now is not going to care about most things that happened today. But the you of 10 years from now is going to care if you had a chance to reach out to someone you were close to and didn't. The you of 10 years from now is going to is going to care if you made a morally transgressive decision, if you had a chance to do the right thing, but you did the wrong thing. The you of 10 years from now is going to care that if you had a chance to take a sensible risk, but instead you played it safe because you were scared, the you of 10 years from now is going to have some words with you. And so, a lot of the other regrets don't, a lot of our other decisions is don't really matter all that much. And so we should just do the best we can and move on.
And I think when you say that, I think that really ties into values. And I mean, of course, both on a personal level and on an organizational level, to know what are the principles that are important to us that we don't want to compromise with and kind of extend them into the future.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, again, a lot of regrets are about values. And, you know, and the thing is that even though there are obviously differences among values from culture to culture and person to person, but there's also commonality. What do we care about in life? We care about some stability. We care about leading a psychologically rich life. We care about doing the right thing, and we care about love. And those are values, and regret clarifies those values.
I'm thinking as a father of three kids, and I think that's one of those situations where I think you so many times deal with that kind of values conflict between where do I spend my time and what is most important now. And I'm thinking, are there some of the ways that you have learned to kind of use anticipated regret in your own life?
Let's go back to connection regrets for a moment. To me, I mean, this is one of the things where this research has changed my point of view. So if I'm at a juncture where I'm thinking, okay, should I reach out to this person or should I not reach out to this person? I think that I've answered the question already. That if I'm at the juncture where I'm even contemplating it, reach out. Always reach out. And I'm not someone who's particularly good at reaching out, but I've changed my view on that based on all this research in regret. Because I know that the me of 10 years from now is going to regret it if I don't reach out today. The me of 10 years from now is not going to care whether I had macaroni and cheese for dinner tonight or crab cakes or hamburgers. Me of 20 is not going to care one whit about that. So I don't need to anticipate that kind of regret. The me of 10 years from now is not going to care whether I drove around a gray car or a blue car. Absolutely not. But I know what the me of 10 years, I have a pretty safe bet what the me of 10 years from now is going to care about. It's going to care about these moral things. It's going to care about, did I take sensible risks? And it's going to care about whether I was connected to people I care about.
And I think in the aspects of the sensible risks, which is one of those, I guess, the boldness regrets, that we didn't write that book or we didn't start that company. And is there something that you can say in terms of how we can kind of anticipate that and be better at actually taking risks?
I think it's hard. I mean, because I don't think we should take every risk. But what I think we should do is we should do some discounting. That I think a lot of times is that our assessment of the risk that we face from certain actions is too high. And we should use a little bit of a deflator, a little bit of a discounter, and notch that down a bit. The other thing is, I think generally we should have a bias for action. More regrets are about inaction rather than action. And so even though you have people who have regrets, who did something bold and it failed, and a few people regret that, many of them don't. So I think that discounting, they go hand in hand. Maybe adjusting your, deflating your risk assessment just a bit, and is useful, as is just generally having a bias for action.
I just thought that was such an important statement. So I just want to highlight it again, that most people have more regrets about inaction than about action. And I think that's so true. I mean, in personal life, and it's so true for us as leaders as well in organizations. And there's this one thing that, I mean, on this podcast, we focus a lot on healthy culture, and what does it mean to build a healthy culture and why that is important. And I'm thinking as we're talking that I don't think you can really have a sustainably healthy culture without learning to navigate regrets in a healthy way. I'm thinking that, I mean, one of the things that I've, through talking to a lot of researchers, identified as, I think, one of the biggest hindrances from having a healthy culture is the idea that we believe ourselves to be a good organization, which means that we're kind of, we want to deflect any information that points out vulnerabilities. And I think we have so much industries today in terms of that, the PR industry, the employee branding industry, all of those are important, and they fill a fill an important role. But I think so many times the things that we do are driven by that that desire to look good to the, on the outside, and to not show any flaws. And so if you speak here to organizational leaders, and maybe if we think maybe especially senior organizational leaders, who I guess and who I think are rightly very concerned about reputational risks, what is something that you would say to them in terms of still maybe practicing this in a better sense, and perhaps getting, I think that we need to get the understanding that we're not going to be able to have an image of perfection, but that it might be better to have an image of honesty.
I would advise them to start small. So, you know, just try the next meeting to disclose one regret that you have. Forget about it at the organizational level. Don't say, oh my gosh, our carbon footprint for the last 20 years has been appallingly large and we totally regret. Start with one small personal regret as a leader and see how people react. And I think you'd be surprised. You know, a lot of times we throw up our hands and we say, well, can I do everything? And we can't. But can you do something is almost, the answer to that question is almost always yes. And so start small, start personal, and see how people react. And I think you'll be surprised.
That's so, so helpful, Dan. So as you've been writing on this book, and if I would ask you, what is kind of the world that you're hoping will kind of emerge out of us, and I guess hundreds of thousands or millions of people reading this book, what kind of shift would you want to see?
Well, I want to reclaim this emotion, and I don't want people ignoring it. I don't want people debilitated by it. I want people confronting it, as we've been doing in this conversation. I want people to realize what you realize, you know, at the very top of this show, which is that regret clarifies what we value and instructs us on how to do better. And if we're open to listening to it rather than hiding from it or being debilitated by it, it's one of the most transformative emotions we have.
And I'm thinking, since when we talk a lot about values, and I think this clarifying values, that if we want our values to go from being these posters and paper products, We both need to talk about the values conflicts and the values dilemmas, but we also need to talk about the regrets.
It's when we talk about regrets, we're talking about values. I mean, in inherently, and so and I'm all for talking about our values, but regrets are actually a very helpful way to surface what those values are.
Is there any kind of last thought or something that you would want to give to, or maybe a first step, and you've already given some to senior leaders, but to our audience of leaders, HR and ethics professional, what is one idea or thought or first step that you would like them to take away from this conversation and from your work?
Well, I mean, I think one thing to do would be have one conversation this week about one of your regrets and see what happens. And I think you'll be surprised how people react. If I were a betting man, I would bet that people are going to offer you the grace that we were talking about before, much more than you realize. Second, I bet they're going to be likely to disclose one of their regrets. And third, I think that the consequence of offering grace, and then they're sharing their own regrets, is going to yield a rich and invigorating conversation.
Thank you so much. And before I ask how people can connect with you, I just want to give a kind of a testimony to the message of your book. And that is, just actually the other day, I was reaching out to a person who I know that many, many years ago that I hurt through my leadership and through things that I was involved with. And I had put away having that conversation with that person because I thought that it was going to be hurtful for that person or whatever. And I guess in many ways, I just hid behind that excuse. But anyway, the other day I reached out to that person, and I'm incredibly glad that I did. So just a testament to the power of doing what you're saying. So Dan, how can people follow and keep learning from your work?
And the best move is to go to my website, which is danpink.com, danpink.com. All kinds of stuff there, newsletter, resources, information about the book, social media links, everything that you could possibly want.
That's awesome. And again, make sure to get Dan's book, The Power of Regret. It's a fantastic read. Super, super, super interesting and such an important subject. So I'm really hoping that a lot of people are going to read it. So Dan, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Tobias, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.